Somewhere along the line, you may have read that every day, each of us makes literally thousands of decisions. Most of these decisions are not major. They're usually along the lines of what sandwich to pack for lunch. Some of these decisions, however, are more detailed, more drawn out, more deliberative, more serious. And some involve competition, whether we like it or not. Competition can take many forms, from actually organized competition that you may enter, such as a chess tournament or a dancing contest, to competitions between yourself, what would euphemistically be called between your heart and your mind, or between what might be called the better angels of your nature versus the devil in your nature. When the decisions and our life paths lead us to competition, it affects us in a number of ways, including physiological, elevated heart rate, increased pulse, breathing, hormones being shifted around in the body. Scientists have measured this effect, both in the medical field as well as the psychological or sociological sciences. Today we'll be discussing a book about competition, about its effect on the individuals, effect on groups, as well as all the ways it comes into your lives, even if you don't notice it. There are some fascinating and quite interesting factors that come into play whenever you try to be the top dog. Welcome to the Nordonia Hills Branch Library Podcast on nonfiction. This month's book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. The authors of this month's book are Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. They have written a quite readable book about winning, losing, and competition, and how it affects each of us. Let's begin with physiology and some of the effects that they describe. In the introduction, I had mentioned how competition can be between you and others, or even within yourself. To begin their book, they describe a study done on the stress levels of first-time skydivers. The test was set up with people who had never gone parachuting before. The scientists measured their saliva by having each person chew on a sponge to get their saliva samples before they went up for their first jump. After they had jumped once, they had to go immediately back up and do it a second time, and then third. The scientists were able to measure that their stress levels actually went down from one jump to two to three, meaning people can be conditioned to experience skydiving, that is, the stress involved with it, and can become used to it so that it doesn't bring out such a pronounced physical response. From this, the authors immediately go to a dance competition that was held within 300 miles of these parachutists, and the same saliva stress study was done among the couples who were competing there at the dance. There was no money at stake for the prize winner, just bragging rights. On average, the competitors in this dance competition had been in 131 previous competitions and on average had been going to contests for 8 years. When they checked the stress levels on these seasoned competitors, they found that the stress was equal to that of someone who was making their second parachute jump. Even without a money prize, even without anything else at stake but bragging rights, the stress was still there in seasoned competitors. The book goes on to describe other physiological factors or features that people have studied to see how it affects competition or one's competitive nature. They found, for example, that if your ring finger is longer than your index finger, it has been shown time after time to suggest that that person has better spatial awareness, is more prone to risk-taking, and is generally more assertive. Beyond the physiological effects, they also discuss about individuals' nature, individual psychology, and behavior. Among the different factors that are discussed are these. One is territorialism. This goes in some part to explain home court advantage, but it also explains things like when you're walking down the street and you pass a complete stranger, you say, "Excuse me." Yes, it's being polite, using your manners. However, scientists have linked this back to the fact that people kind of subconsciously know that the person, quote, owns that space in front of them on the sidewalk. And so if you're cutting in front of them, then you are having to excuse yourself for invading their territory. They also confirm what every one of us knows, especially in November and December during holiday shopping season, that they've actually studied the fact that if you have a person waiting for a parking spot, the person who is backing out will take twice as long as they would have if there was no one waiting at all. There is some sort of subconscious, "this is my parking spot" territorialism in effect. So if that person is taking too long to back out of their spot over at the Quickie Mart, then you know exactly why. It's science. They look at a study in which people who arrive early do better in competitions than people who arrive later. Now, this isn't something like someone who arrives early or on time does better than someone who arrives late. They've actually done studies where in a video game competition, competitors who arrived as little as 10 seconds ahead of their competition actually did better in the contests. The authors also write about one's personal toolbox, as it were, of things to be able to deal with setbacks, obstacles, or defeats. They've done studies as to how people compete in terms of their mindset. Not everybody competes best when they're calm. Some people really need to work themselves up to get fired up, as it were. Instead, scientists have looked and said a better way to determine how someone competes is how they use counterfactuals. Counterfactuals identify the way you're thinking is positive or negative. And they go to specify that it's not positive versus negative thinking. It's rather additive versus subtractive thinking. So explain. An additive counterfactual is something along the lines of, "if only I had spoken up in the meeting." A subtractive counterfactual would be more along the lines of, "if only I hadn't said anything at the meeting." A subtractive counterfactual expresses regret over a mistake or a failed strategy. An additive counterfactual sees new strategies and options which add to the choices that people have when they're next in a similar situation. Both types of counterfactuals allows you to reflect on what happened that led to the defeat or the setback. Additive thinking allows you to overcome it and add it to your toolbox, as it were, to deal with things in the future. Subtractive thinking redounds to you, where you are more focused on your setback and how you made the mistake, rather than how to overcome it or avoid it next time. Beyond individuals, the authors also discuss groups and teams. There are a number of different anecdotes and studies that they write about in the book that discuss how the composition of groups and the size of groups have on individual achievement and competition. They describe what is known as the N effect. The larger the number of participants involved in a task, the worse the outcome for the individuals who are participating. Sort of along the lines of when there's only a few people in a race, you put your foot on the gas, working harder to outpace the competitors. In contrast, when you're against a whole lot of competitors, many, many competitors, we don't care as much about how we stack up against our other competitor, or against just one other competitor. Once the crowd is large enough that we don't find the element of personal competition, the results don't feel like a personal statement of our worth, so we don't try as hard. The authors also look at the composition of teams and how that affects the final outcome. They discuss a professor, J. Richard Hackman, who was asked by the government after 9/11 to take a look at how the internal structure of some of the intelligence community was working or not working to solve problems and come up with plans. To make a long story short, one of the end results was what Hackman calls the 60-30-10 rule. Having studied teams in many settings, from cockpits of airlines to orchestras, the professor believes that 60% of a team's fate has been written before the team members even meet. Its destiny is decided by a combination of the team leader's efficacy, whether the team's goal is challenging yet attainable, and the ability level of the people recruited for the team. Another 30% of the team's fate is sealed with the initial launch of the team members, how they meet initially, and the initial exchanges that they have, how they split up responsibilities and the tasks before them. All told, according to Professor Hackman, 90% of a team's fate has been decided before the team ever begins its real work. Either as individuals or within a group setting, the authors describe how competition is all around us and how it affects us, for better or for worse. The authors even take on that hallowed stereotype of the art is beyond competition, pointing out that whenever there is a competition between artists, there is increased creativity. They relate the anecdote of how Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo were both hired to paint murals on opposite walls of Florence's Palazzo Vecchio. Even in art, competition breeds creativity and excellence. And even within a group setting, individuals value competition. They write about Professor Agnes Strybeck, who surveyed a couple thousand students attending 9 different colleges and universities. On the survey, she was discussing the job hunting that these students would be doing after graduation, showing the students that were being surveyed a number of job ads. Her results showed that whenever the ad mentioned teamwork, the very best students had no interest whatsoever in the position. The idea of forced collaboration drove the best and brightest away. They believed that a team environment would not be personally challenging. There would be little opportunity to grow, learn, and develop new skills. The effects were so strong and so repeated that she issued a warning to employers. Even a mere mention of the word teamwork in a job ad likely will lower the quality of the entire pool of job applicants. The best aren't going to apply. They'll look for opportunities where they can shine, where they feel responsible for their destiny. As you get down to the end of the book, the authors identify that one thing that, above all, will signify success, whether or not faced with high competition or high levels of obstacles in your way. They boil it down to one word, and that word is agency. Agency is the capacity to act independently, to make one's own free choices, and to make decisions quickly. Agency is the core inside self-starters, the trait that grows into personal initiative. People who are low in agency don't trust themselves and more reliant on others' leadership. They give up easily. The authors suggest that rather than develop self-esteem in younger people, leaders should be focused on developing agency. This book is very well written, very well thought out. It is not a tedious read. The studies and the results that are cited, the scientists that are quoted, are not done in an academic style. It is done very much in a casual style. As I said at the outset, there are 240 pages of text, followed by 80 pages of selected sources, references, and notes. There is also an index. I'll end with a quote by Walt Disney, which can be applicable to any one of us out here in today's world. "I have been up against tough competition all my life. I wouldn't know how to get along without it." So if you wish to gain a little bit of insight into how we compete, how we make decisions, how we interact with each other within groups, teams, and all the related factors that go into that, I highly recommend Top Dog by Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. Before our next podcast, you will be happy to know that our Mind, Body, and Soul summer reading program will be returning here in June. We hope you stop by and register, catch up on some summer reading, participate in some movement, and you can win some wonderful prizes. Mind, Body, and Soul 2018 starts the first week of June. Join us again next month when we'll discuss another topic on nonfiction. Until then, we will see you at your Nordonia Hills Branch Library. Music by 20 Riverside, provided by Mevio's Music Alley, music.mevio.com. Thank you for listening.